were soaked with sweat, hair straggling wet on their necks. Jamie wiped his face with his sleeve, still breathing hard.
How many children?
Roger's own breath was short, his throat so raw that the words were barely a whisper.
Three, at least.
Jamie coughed, hawked, and spat.
The eldest is 12, maybe.
He stood for a moment, looking at the bodies. Then he crossed himself and drew his dirk to cut them down. They had nothing to dig with. The best that could be managed was a wide scrape in the leaf mould of the forest, and a thin cairn of rocks, as much to spite the ravens as for the sake of decency.
"Were they regulators?"
Roger asked, pausing in the midst of it to wipe his face on his sleeve.
"Aye, but..."
Jamie's voice trailed away.
"It's not to do with that business."
He shook his head and turned away to gather more rocks. Roger thought it was a rock at first, half hidden in the leaves that had drifted against the scorched cabin wall. He touched it, and it moved, bringing him to his feet with a cry that would have done credit to any of the Corbies. Jamie reached him in seconds, in time to help dig the little girl out of the leaves and cinders.
"Hush, Owen, hush,"
Jamie said urgently, though in fact the child wasn't crying. She was maybe 8, her clothes and hair burned away, and her skin so blackened and cracked that she might have been made of stone indeed, save for her eyes.
"Oh, God! Oh, God!"
Roger kept saying it under his breath long after it became clear that if it was a prayer, it was long past answering. He was cradling her against his chest, and her eyes opened halfway, regarding him with nothing like relief or curiosity, only a calm fatality. Jamie had poured water from his canteen onto a handkerchief. He fed the tip of it between her lips to wet them, and Roger saw her throat move in reflex as she sucked.
"You'll be all right," Roger whispered to her. "It's all right, Eliannon."
"Who has done this, Ian?"
Jamie asked, just as gently. Roger saw that she understood. The question stirred the surface of her eyes like wind on a pond, but then passed over, leaving them calm again. She didn't speak, no matter what questions they asked, only looked at them with incurious eyes and went on sucking dreamily at the wet cloth.
"Are you baptized, Eliannon?"
Jamie asked her at last. And Roger felt a deep jolt at the question. In the shock of finding her, he hadn't truly taken in her condition.
"Elle ne peut plus vivre,"
Jamie said softly, his eyes meeting Roger's.
"She cannot live."
His first instinct was a visceral denial.
Of course she could live. She must.
But huge patches of her skin were gone, the raw flesh crusted but still oozing. He could see the white edge of a knee bone, and literally see her heart beating, a reddish, translucent bulge that pulsed at the notch of her ribcage. She was light as a corn dolly, and he became painfully aware that she seemed to float in his arms, like a slick of oil on water.
"Does it hurt, sweetheart?"
he asked her.
"Mama,"
she whispered. Then she closed her eyes and would say no more, only muttering,
"Mama,"
now and then. He had thought at first they would take her back to the ridge, to Claire. But it was more than a day's ride. She wouldn't make it. Not possibly. He swallowed, realization closing on his throat like a noose. He looked at Jamie, seeing the same sick acknowledgement in his eyes. Jamie swallowed too.
"Do you know her name?"
Roger could scarcely breathe and force the words. Jamie shook his head, then gathered himself, hunching his shoulders. She had stopped sucking, but still murmured,
"Mama?"
now and then. Jamie took the handkerchief from her lips and squeezed a few drops from it onto her blackened forehead, whispering the words of baptism. Then they looked at each other, acknowledging necessity. Jamie was pale, sweat beading on his upper lip among the bristles of red beard. He took a deep breath, steeling himself, and lifted his hands, offering.
"No," Roger said softly. "I'll do it."
She was his. He could no more surrender her to another than he could have torn off an arm. He reached for the handkerchief, and Jamie put it into his hand, soot-stained, still damp. He'd never thought of such a thing, and couldn't think now. He didn't need to. Without hesitation, he cradled her close and put the handkerchief over her nose and mouth, then clamped his hand tight over the cloth, feeling the small bump of her nose caught snug between his thumb and index finger. Wind stirred in the leaves above, and a rain of gold fell on them, whispering on his skin, brushing cool past his face. She would be cold, he thought, and wished to cover her, but had no hand to spare. His other arm was round her, hand resting on her chest. He could feel the tiny heart beneath his fingers. It jumped, beat rapidly, skipped, beat twice more, and stopped. It quivered for a moment. He could feel it trying to find enough strength to beat one last time, and suffered the momentary illusion that it would not only do so, but would force its way through the fragile wall of her chest and into his hand in its urge to live. But the moment passed, as did the illusion, and a great stillness came. Near at hand, a raven called. They had almost finished the burying when the sound of hooves and jingling harness announced visitors. A lot of visitors. Roger, ready to decamp into the woods, glanced at his father-in-law, but Jamie shook his head, answering his unasked question.
Nay, they'd no come back. What for?
His bleak gaze took in the smoking ruin of the homestead, the trampled dooryard, and the low mounds of the graves. The little girl still lay nearby, covered with Roger's cloak. He hadn't been able to bear putting her into the ground just yet. The knowledge of her alive was still too recent. Jamie straightened, stretching his back. Roger saw him glance to see that his rifle was to hand, leaning against a tree trunk. Then he settled himself, leaning on the scorched board he'd been using as a shovel, waiting. The first of the riders came out of the woods, his horse snorting and tossing its head at the smell of burning. The rider pulled it skillfully round and urged it closer, leaning forward to see who they were.
"So it's you, is it, Fraser?"
Richard Brown's lined face looked grimly jovial. He glanced at the charred and steaming timbers, then round at his comrades.
"Didn't think you made your money just by selling whiskey."
The men, Roger counted six of them, shifted in their saddles, snorting with amusement.
"Have a bit of respect for the dead, Brown."
Jamie nodded at the graves, and Brown's face hardened. He glanced sharply at Jamie, then at Roger.
"Just the two of you, is it? What are you doing here?"
"Digging graves," Roger said.
His palms were blistered. He rubbed a hand slowly on the side of his breeches.
"What are you doing here?"
Brown straightened abruptly in his saddle, but it was his brother Lionel who answered.
"Coming down from a Winnowisku," he said, jerking his head at the horses.
Looking, Roger saw that there were four pack horses laden with skins, and that several of the other horses carried bulging saddlebags.
"Smelled the fire and came to see."
He glanced down at the graves.
"Tige O'Brien, was it?"
Jamie nodded.
"You kent them?"
Richard Brown shrugged.
"Aye. It's on the way to a Winnowisku. I've stopped a time or two, taken supper with them."
Belatedly he removed his hat, plastering down wisps of hair over his balding crown with the flat of his hand. God rest them.
Who's burnt them out if it wasn't you?
One of the younger men in the party called. The man, a brown by his narrow shoulders and lantern jaw, grinned inappropriately, evidently thinking this a jest. The singed bit of paper had flown with the wind. It fluttered against a rock near Roger's foot. He picked it up and, with a step forward, slapped it against Lionel Brown's saddle.
"Know anything about that, do you?" he asked. "It was pinned to O'Brien's body."
He sounded angry, knew it, and didn't care. His throat ached and his voice came out as a strangled rasp. Lionel Brown glanced at the paper, brows raised, then handed it to his brother.
"No. Write it yourself, did you?"
"What?"
He stared up at the man, blinking against the wind.
"Injuns," Lionel Brown said, nodding at the house. "Injuns done this." "Why?"
Roger could hear the undercurrents in Jamie's voice. Skepticism, wariness, and anger.
"Which Indians? The ones from whom you bought the hides? Told you about it, did they?" "Don't be a fool, Nelly."
Richard Brown kept his voice pitched low, but his brother flinched a little, hearing it. Brown edged his horse nearer.
Jamie stood his ground, though Roger saw his hands tighten on the board. "Got the whole family, did they?" he asked, glancing at the small body under its cloak.
"No," Jamie said. "We've not found the two elder children, only the wee lassie."
"Indians," Lionel Brown repeated stubbornly from behind his brother. "They took 'em."
Jamie took a deep breath and coughed from the smoke.
"Aye," he said. "I'll ask in the villages, then." "Won't find 'em," Richard Brown said.
He crumpled the note, tightening his fist suddenly.
"If Indians took 'em, they won't keep them near. They'll sell them on into Kentucky."
There was a general mutter of agreement among the men, and Roger felt the ember that had simmered in his chest all afternoon burst into fire.
"Indians didn't write that," he snapped, jerking a thumb at the note in Brown's hand. "And if it was revenge against O'Brien for being a regulator, they wouldn't have taken the children."
Brown gave him a long look, eyes narrowed. Roger felt Jamie shift his weight slightly, preparing.
"No," said Brown softly, "they wouldn't. That's why Nelly figured you wrote it yourself. Say the Indians came and stole the little uns, but then you come along and decide to take what's left. So you fired the cabin, hung O'Brien and his wife, pinned that note, and here you are. How say you to that bit of reasoning, Mr. Mackenzie?"
"I'd ask you how you kent they were hanged, Mr. Brown."
Brown's face tightened, and Roger felt Jamie's hand on his arm in warning, realizing only then that his fists were clenched.
"The ropes are harritch," Jamie said, his voice very calm.
The words penetrated dimly, and he looked. True, the ropes they had cut from the bodies lay by the tree where they had fallen. Jamie was still talking, his voice still calm, but Roger couldn't hear the words. The wind deafened him, and just below the whine of it he heard the intermittent soft thump of a beating heart. It might have been his own. Or hers.
"Get off that horse," he said.
Or thought he had. The wind swept into his face, heavy with soot, and the words caught in his throat. The taste of ash was thick and sour in his mouth. He coughed and spat, eyes watering. Vaguely, he became aware of a pain in his arm, and the world swam back into view. The younger men were staring at him, with expressions ranging from smirks to wariness. Richard Brown and his brother were both sedulously avoiding looking at him, focused instead on Jamie, who was still gripping his arm. With an effort, he shook off Jamie's hand, giving his father-in-law the slightest nod by way of reassurance that he wasn't about to go berserk, though his heart still pounded and the feel of the noose was so tight about his throat that he couldn't have spoken, even if he had been able to form words.
"We'll help."
Brown nodded at the little body on the ground and began to swing one leg over his saddle, but Jamie stopped him with a small gesture.
"Nay, we'll manage."
Brown stopped, awkwardly, half on, half off. His lips thinned, and he pulled himself back on, reined around, and rode off with no word of farewell. The others followed, looking curiously back as they went.
"That wasna them."
Jamie had taken up his rifle and held it, gazing at the wood where the last of the men had disappeared.
"They ken something more about it than they'll say, though."
Roger nodded, wordless. He walked deliberately to the hanging tree, kicked aside the ropes and drove his fist into the trunk, twice, three times. Stood panting, his forehead pressed against the rough bark. The pain of raw knuckles helped a bit. A trail of tiny ants was scurrying upward between the plates of bark, bound on some momentous business, all absorbing. He watched them for a little until he could swallow again. Then straightened up and went to bury her, rubbing at the bone-deep bruise on his arm. Part 4. Abduction. Chapter 26. An Eye to the Future. October the 9th, 1773. Roger dropped his saddlebags on the ground beside the pit and peered in.
"Where's Jem?" he said.
His mud-smeared wife looked up at him and brushed a sweat-matted lock of hair out of her face.
"Hello to you too," she said. "Have a good trip?"
"No," he said. "Where's Jem?"
Her brows rose at that, and she stabbed her shovel into the bottom of the pit, extending a hand for him to help her scramble out.
"He's at Masali's. He and Germaine are playing vroom with the little cars you made them." "Or they were when I left him there."
The knot of anxiety he had carried under his ribs for the last 2 weeks began slowly to relax. He nodded, a sudden spasm of the throat preventing him from speaking, then reached out and pulled her to him, crushing her against him in spite of her startled yelp and mud-stained clothes. He held her hard, his own heart hammering loud in his ears, and wouldn't, couldn't let go until she wriggled out of his embrace. She kept her hands on his shoulders, but cocked her head to one side, one brow raised.
"Here, I missed you too," she said.
"What's wrong? What happened?"
"Terrible things."
The burning, the little girl's death. These had become dreamlike during their travel, their horror muted to the surreal by the monotonous labour of riding, walking, the constant whine of wind and crunch of boots on gravel, sand, pine needles, mud, the engulfing blur of greens and yellows in which they lost themselves beneath an endless sky. But now he was home, no longer adrift in the wilderness. And the memory of the girl who had left her heart in his hand was suddenly as real as she had been in the moment she died.
"You come inside."
Brianna was peering closely at him, concerned.
"You need something hot, Roger."
"I'm all right," he said,
but followed her without protest. He sat at the table while she put the kettle on for tea and told her everything that had happened, head in his hands, staring down at the battered tabletop with its homely spills and burn scars.
"I kept thinking there must be something, some way. But there wasn't. Even while I put my hand over her face, I was sure it wasn't really happening. But at the same time..."
He sat up then, looking into the palms of his hands. At the same time, it had been the most vivid experience of his life. He couldn't bear to think of it, save in the most fleeting way, but knew he could never forget the slightest thing about it. His throat closed suddenly again. Brianna looked searchingly into his face, saw his hand touch the ragged rope scar on his throat. "Can you breathe?" she said anxiously. He shook his head, but it wasn't true. He was breathing somehow, though it felt as though his throat had been crushed in some huge hand, larynx and windpipe mangled into a bloody mass. He flapped a hand to indicate that he would be all right, much as he doubted it himself. She came round behind him, pulled his hand from his throat, and laid her own fingers lightly over the scar. "It'll be all right," she said quietly. "Just breathe. Don't think. Just breathe." Her fingers were cold and her hands smelled of dirt. There was water in his eyes. He blinked, wanting to see the room, the hearth and candle and dishes and loom, to convince himself of where he was. A drop of warm moisture rolled down his cheek. He tried to tell her that it was all right. He wasn't crying. But she merely pressed closer, holding him against the chest with one arm, the other hand still cool on the painful lump in his throat. Her breasts were soft against his back, and he could feel, rather than hear, her humming, the small, tuneless noise she made when she was anxious or concentrating very hard. Finally, the spasm began to ease, and the feel of choking left him. His chest swelled with the unbelievable relief of a free breath, and she let go. "What is it that you're digging?" he asked, with only a little effort. He looked round at her and smiled, with a lot more. "A barbecue pit? For a hippopotamus?" The ghost of a smile touched her face, though her eyes were still dark with concern. "No," she said. "It's a groundhog kiln." He tried for a moment to compose some witty remark about it being a really large hole for killing something as small as a groundhog, but he wasn't up to it. "Oh," he said instead. He took the hot mug of catnip tea she placed in his hand and held it near his face, letting the fragrant steam warm his nose and mist on the cold skin of his cheeks. Brianna poured out a mug for herself as well and sat down across from him. "I'm glad you're home," she said softly.
"Yeah, me too."
He essayed a sip. It was still scalding.
"A kiln?"
He'd told her about the O'Briens. He had to. But he didn't want to talk about it. Not now. She seemed to sense this and didn't press him. "Uh-huh. For the water." He must have looked confused, for her smile grew more genuine.
"I told you there was dirt involved, didn't I?
Besides, it was your idea."
"It was?"
At this point, almost nothing would surprise him, but he had no memory of having bright ideas about water. The problem of bringing water to the houses was one of transport.
God knew there was plenty of water. It ran in creeks, fell in waterfalls, dripped from ledges, sprang from springs, seeped in boggy patches under the cliffs. But making it go where you wanted required some method of containment.
"Mr. Weems told Frau Berisch, that's his girlfriend, Frau Uta fixed them up, what I was doing, and she told him that the men's choir over in Salem was working on the same problem, so..."
"The choir?"
He tried another cautious sip and found it drinkable.
"Why would the choir?" "That's just what they call them. There's the single men's choir, the single women's choir, the married choir. They don't just sing together, though. It's more like a social group, and each choir has particular jobs they do for the community. But anyway..."
She flapped a hand. "They're trying to bring water into the town and having the same problem. No metal for pipes.
You remember, though, you reminded me about the pottery they do in Salem. Well, they tried making water pipes out of logs, but that's really hard and time-consuming, because you have to bore the middle of the log out with an auger, and you still need metal collars to bind the logs together. And they rot after a while. But then they had the same idea you had. Why not make pipes out of fired clay?"
She was becoming animated, talking about it. Her nose was no longer red from cold, but her cheeks were flushed pink and her eyes bright with interest. She waved her hands when she talked. She got that from her mother, he thought to himself, amused. So, we parked the kids with Mama and Mrs. Bug, and Massali and I went to Salem.
Massali? But she couldn't be riding, surely.
Massali was enormously pregnant, to the point that merely being around her made him slightly nervous, for fear she might go into labour at any moment. She isn't due for a month. Besides, we didn't ride. We took the wagon and traded honey and cider and venison for cheese and quilts and... See my new teapot? Proud, she waved at the pot. A homely, squat thing, with a red-brown glaze and yellow, squiggly shapes painted round the middle. It was one of the uglier objects he'd ever seen, and the sight of it made tears come to his eyes from the sheer joy of being home.
You don't like it, she said, a small frown forming between her brows. No, it's great, he said hoarsely.
He fumbled for a handkerchief and blew his nose to hide his emotion.
Love it. You were saying, Massali.
I was saying about the water pipes. But there's something about Massali, too. The frown deepened. I'm afraid Fergus isn't behaving very well.
No? What's he doing? Having a mad affair with Mrs. Crombie?
This suggestion was greeted with a withering look, but it didn't last. He's gone a lot, for one thing, leaving poor Massali to mind the children and do all the work.
Totally normal for the time, he observed. Most men do that. Your father does that. I do that. Had you not noticed?
I noticed, she said, giving him a faintly evil look. But what I mean is, most men do the heavy work, like ploughing and planting, and let their wives manage the inside stuff. The cooking and the spinning and the weaving and the laundry and the preserving and... Well, anyway, all that stuff. But Masali's doing it all, plus the kids and the outdoor work and working at the malting floor. And when Fergus is home, he's grumpy and he drinks too much.
This also sounded like normal behaviour for the father of three small, wild children, and the husband of a very pregnant wife, Roger thought, but didn't say so.
I'd not have thought Fergus a layabout, he observed mildly.
Bree shook her head, still frowning, and poured more tea into his mug. No, he's not lazy, really. It's hard for him with only one hand. He really can't handle some of the heavy chores. But he won't help with the kids, or cook and clean while Massali does them. Da and Ian help with the ploughing, but... And he leaves for days on end. Sometimes he's picking up little jobs here and there, translating for a traveller, but mostly he's just gone. And...
She hesitated, darting a look at him as though wondering whether to go on.
And? He said obligingly.
The tea was working. The pain in his throat was almost gone. She looked down at the table, drawing invisible patterns on the oak with a forefinger.
She didn't say so, but I think he hits her.
Roger felt a sudden weight on his heart. His first reaction was to dismiss the notion out of hand, but he'd seen too much living with the Reverend. Too many families, outwardly content and respectable, where the wives poked fun at their own clumsiness, brushing away any concern at black eyes, broken noses, dislocated wrists. Too many men who dealt with the pressures of providing for a family by resorting to the bottle.
"Damn,"
he said, feeling suddenly exhausted. He rubbed at his forehead where a headache was starting.
"Why do you think so?" he asked bluntly. Has she got marks?
Bree nodded unhappily, still not looking up, though her finger had stilled. On her arm. She wrapped a hand around her forearm in illustration. Little round bruises, like finger marks. I saw when she reached up to get a bucket of honeycomb from the wagon and her sleeve fell back. He nodded, wishing there was something stronger than tea in his mug.
"Shall I talk to him, then, do you think?"
She did look up at him then, her eyes softening, though the look of worry remained. "You know, most men wouldn't offer to do that."
"Well, it's not my idea of fun," he admitted. "But you cannot let that sort of thing go on, hoping it will cure itself. Someone has to say something." God knew what, though, or how.
He was already regretting the offer, trying to think what the hell he could say.
"So, Fergus, old man, here you're beating your wife. Be a good fellow and stop that, okay?"
He drained the rest of his mug and got up to look for the whiskey. "We're out," Brianna said, seeing his intent. "Mr. Weems had a cold." He put down the empty bottle with a sigh. She touched his arm delicately.
"We're invited up to the big house for supper. We could go early."
That was a cheering suggestion. Jamie invariably had a bottle of excellent single malt secreted somewhere on the premises.
"Aye, all right."
He took her cloak from the peg and swung it round her shoulders.
"Hey, do you think I should mention the business about Fergus to your da? Or best handle it myself?"
He had a sudden, unworthy hope that Jamie would consider it his business and take care of the matter. That seemed to be what Brianna was afraid of. She was shaking her head, simultaneously fluffing out her half-dried hair. "No, I think Da would break his neck. And Fergus wouldn't be any good to Masali if he's dead."
"Mm-hmm."
He accepted the inevitable and opened the door for her. The big white house glowed on the hill above them, tranquil in the afternoon light. The big red spruce behind it, a looming but benign presence. Not for the first time he felt that the tree was somehow guarding the house, and in his present fragile mental state, found that notion a comfort. They made a short detour, so he could properly admire the new pit and be told all about the internal workings of a groundhog kiln. He failed to follow these in any detail, only grasping the notion that the point was to make the inside very hot. But he found the flow of Brianna's explanation soothing. "Bricks for the chimney," she was saying, pointing at the far end of the 8-foot pit, which at present resembled nothing so much as the resting place for an extremely large coffin. She'd made a nice, neat job of it so far, though. The corners were squared as though done with an instrument of some sort, and the walls painstakingly smoothed. He said as much, and she beamed at him, thumbing a lock of red hair behind her ear. "It needs to be a lot deeper," she said, "maybe another 3 feet. But the dirt here is really good for digging. It's soft, but it doesn't crumble too much. I hope I can finish the hole before it starts to snow, but I don't know." She rubbed a knuckle under her nose, squinting dubiously at the hole. "I really need to card and spin enough more wool to weave the fabric for winter shirts for you and Jem. But I'll have to pick and preserve for the next week or so, and..."
"I'll dig it for you."
She stood on tiptoe and kissed him, just under the ear. And he laughed, suddenly feeling better.
"Not for this winter," she said, taking him contentedly by the arm. "But eventually, I'm wondering if I can vent some of the heat from the kiln and run it under the floor of the cabin. You know what a Roman hypocaust is?"
"I do."
He turned to eye the foundation of his domicile, a simple hollow base of fieldstone on which the log walls were built. The notion of central heating in a crude mountain cabin made him want to laugh. But there was really nothing impossible about it, he supposed.
"You'd what? Run pipes of warm air through the foundation stones?"
"Yes. Always assuming I can actually make good pipes, which remains to be seen. What do you think?"
He glanced from the proposed project up the hill to the big house. Even at this distance, a mound of dirt by the foundation was visible, evidence of the white sow's burrowing capabilities.
"I think you run a great danger of having that big white buggeress transfer her affections to us, if you make a cosy warm den under our house."
Buggeress, she said, diverted. Is that physically possible?
It's a metaphysical description, he informed her. And you saw what she tried to do to Major MacDonald.
That pig really doesn't like Major MacDonald, Bree said reflectively. I wonder why not.
Ask your mother. She's none so fond of him either.
Oh, well, that... She stopped suddenly, lips pursed, and looked thoughtfully at the big house. A shadow passed the window of the surgery, someone moving inside. Tell you what, you find Da and have a drink with him. And while you're doing that, I'll tell Mama about Marsali and Fergus. She might have a good idea.
I don't know that it's a medical problem exactly, he said, but anesthetizing Germaine would certainly be a start.
Chapter 27 The Malting Floor. I could smell the sweet, musty scent of damp grain on the wind as I made my way up the trail. It was nothing like the heady pungency of the balm mash, the faintly coffee-like toasted smell of malting, nor yet the reek of distilling, but still spoke as strongly of whisky. It was a very fragrant business making Usquebaugh, and the reason why the whisky clearing was located nearly a mile from the big house. As it was, I often caught a wild, faint scent of spirit through my open surgery windows when the wind was right and the mash was making. The whisky-making had its own cycle, and one that everyone on the ridge was subconsciously attuned to, whether directly involved in it or not, which was how I knew, without asking, that the barley in the malting shed had just begun its germination, and therefore Marsali would be there, turning and spreading the grain evenly before the malting fire was lit. The grain must be allowed to germinate to assure a maximal sweetness, but mustn't sprout, or the mash would have a bitter taste and be ruined. No more than 24 hours must pass after germination began, and I had smelled the fecund, damp scent of the grain begin to rise as I foraged in the woods the afternoon before. The time was here. It was by far the best place to have a private conversation with Marsali. The whisky clearing was the only place she was ever without a cacophonous assortment of children. I often thought that she valued the solitude of the work much more than the share of whisky Jamie gave her for minding the grain, valuable though that was. Brianna told me that Roger had gallantly offered to have a word with Fergus, but I thought that I should talk to Marsali first, just to find out what was really going on. What ought I to say? I wondered. A straightforward, is Fergus beating you? I couldn't quite believe that, despite, or perhaps because of, an intimate knowledge of emergency rooms filled with the debris of domestic disputes. It wasn't that I thought Fergus incapable of violence. He'd seen, and experienced, any amount of it from an early age, and growing up among Highlanders in the middle of the Rising, and its aftermath, probably did not inculcate a young man with any deep regard for the virtues of peace. On the other hand, Jenny Murray had had a hand in his upbringing. I tried and failed to imagine any man who had lived with Jamie's sister for more than a week ever lifting his hand to a woman. Besides, I knew by my own observations that Fergus was a very gentle father, and there was usually an easiness between him and Marsali that seemed... There was a sudden commotion overhead. Before I could so much as glance up, something huge crashed down through the branches in a shower of dust and dead pine needles. I leapt backward and swung my basket up in instinctive defence. But even as I did so, I realised that I wasn't, in fact, being attacked. Germaine lay flat on the path in front of me, eyes bulging as he struggled for the breath that had been knocked out of him. "What on earth?" I began rather crossly. Then I saw that he was clutching something to his chest, a late nest filled with a clutch of 4 greenish eggs, which he had miraculously contrived not to break in his fall.
for maman, he gasped, grinning up at me. Very nice, I said. I had had enough to do with young males. Well, any age, really. They all did it. To realize the complete futility of reproach in such situations. And since he had broken neither the eggs nor his legs, I merely took the nest and held it while he gulped for air, and my heart resumed beating at its normal speed. Recovered, he scrambled to his feet, disregarding the dirt, pitch, and broken pine needles that covered him from head to toe. "Maman's in the shed," he said, reaching for his treasure. "You come too, grand-mère?" "Yes." "Where are your sisters?" I asked suspiciously. "Are you meant to be watching them?"
"Non,"
he said airily. "They are at home. That's where women belong." "Oh, really? And who told you that?"
"I forget."
Thoroughly recovered, he hopped ahead of me singing a song, the refrain of which seemed to be,
"No titch, no titch, no titch, Jama."
Masali was indeed at the whiskey clearing. Her cap, cloak, and gown hung from a branch of the yellow-leaved persimmon, and a clay firepot full of coals sat nearby, smoking in readiness. The malting floor had been enclosed now by proper walls, making a shed in which the damp grain could be heaped, first to germinate, and then to be gently toasted by a low-burning fire under the floor. The ash and charcoal had been scraped out, and oak wood for a new fire laid in the space beneath the stilted floor, but it wasn't yet lit. Even without a fire, the shed was warm. I felt it from several feet away. As the grain germinated, it gave off such heat that the shed fairly glowed with it. A rhythmic shush and scrape came from within. Masali was turning the grain with a wooden shovel, making sure it was evenly spread before lighting the malting fire. The door of the shed was open, but there were, of course, no windows. From a distance, I could see only a dim shadow moving within. The shushing of the grain had masked our footsteps. Masali looked up, startled, when my body blocked the light from the doorway. "Mother Claire!"
"Hello," I said cheerfully. "Germaine said you were here. I thought I'd just..."
"Maman, look, look, see what I have."
Germaine pushed past me with single-minded eagerness, thrusting out his prize. Masali smiled at him and pushed a damp strand of fair hair back behind her ear.
"Oh, aye? Well, that's grand, no? Let's take it out to the light, shall we, so I can have a proper look?"
She stepped out of the shed, sighing in pleasure at the touch of the cool air. She was stripped to her shift, the muslin so wet with sweat that I could see not only the dark rounds of her areoli, but even the tiny bulge of her popped-out navel, where the cloth clung to the massive curves of her belly. Masali sat down with another huge sigh of relief, stretching her legs out, bare toes pointed. Her feet were somewhat swollen, and blue veins showed, distended, beneath the transparent skin of her legs.
"Ah, it's good to sit. So then, Akishla, show me what you've got."
I took the opportunity to circle round behind her as Germaine displayed his prize and covertly checked for bruises or other sinister signs. She was thin, but Masali simply was thin, bar the bulge of her pregnancy, and always had been. Her arms were slender but hard with muscle, as were her legs. There were smudges of tiredness beneath her eyes, but she had three small children, after all, besides the discomforts of pregnancy to keep her awake. Her face was rosy and damp, thoroughly healthy-looking. There were a couple of small bruises on her lower legs, but I dismissed those. Pregnant women did bruise easily, and with all the obstructions presented by living in a log cabin and traversing wild mountains, there were few people on the ridge, male or female, not sporting the odd contusion. Or was I only seeking excuses, not wanting to admit the possibility of what Brianna had suggested?
"One for me," Germaine was explaining, touching the eggs, "and one for Joan, and one for Félicité, and one for Monsieur Leuf."
He pointed at the melon-like swell of her stomach.
"Ah, now what a sweet lad," Missali said, pulling him close and kissing his smudged forehead. "You're my wee nestling, to be sure."
Germaine's beam of pleasure faded into a look of speculation as he came in contact with his mother's protruding belly. He patted it cautiously.
"When the egg hatches inside, what do you do with the shell?" he inquired. "Can I have it?"
Missali went pink with suppressed laughter. "People dinna come in shells," she said. "Thank God."
"You are sure, Maman?"
He eyed her belly dubiously, then poked it gently.
"It feels like an egg."
"Well, so it does, but it's not. That's only what Papa and I call a wee one before it's born. You were Monsieur Leuf once,
aye?" "I was."
Germaine looked thunderstruck at this revelation.
"You were? So were your sisters."
Germaine frowned, shaggy blonde fringe almost touching his nose.
"No, they weren't. They are Mademoiselle Les Oeufs."
"Oui, certainement," Missali said, laughing at him.
"And perhaps this one is too, but Monsieur is easier to see. Here, look."
She leaned back a little and pushed a hand firmly into the side of her mound. Then she seized Germaine's hand and put it on the spot. Even from where I stood, I could see the surge of flesh as the baby kicked vigorously in response to being poked. Germaine jerked his hand away, startled, then put it back, looking fascinated, and pushed.
"Allô," he said loudly, putting his face close to his mother's belly. "Comment ça va in there, Monsieur Leuf?"
"He's fine," his mother assured him. "Or she. But babies dinna talk right at first. You ken that. Félicité doesn't see anything but Mama yet."
"Oh, aye."
Losing interest in his impending sibling, he stooped to pick up an interesting-looking stone. Missali lifted her head, squinting at the sun.
"You should go home, Germaine. Mirabelle will be wanting milked, and I've a bit to do here yet. Go and help Papa, aye?"
Mirabelle was a goat, and a sufficiently new addition to the household as still to be interesting, for Germaine brightened at the suggestion.
"Oui, maman. Au revoir, grand-mère."
He took aim and flipped his rock at the shed, missing it, then turned and scampered toward the path.
"Germaine,"
Missali called after him.
"Not it."
"What does that mean?" I asked curiously.
"It's Gaelic, is it? Or French?"
"It's the Gaelic," she said, smiling. "It means don't fall." She shook her head in mock dismay. "That laddie canna stay out of trees to save his life." Germaine had left the nest with its eggs. She set it gently on the ground, and I saw then the faint yellowed ovals on the underside of her forearm, faded, but just as Brianna had described them. "And how is Fergus?" I asked, as though it had anything to do with the conversation.
"He's well enough," she replied,
a look of wariness closing over her features.
"Really?"
I glanced deliberately at her arm, then into her eyes. She flushed and turned her arm quickly, hiding the marks.
"Aye, he's fine," she said. "He's no very good at the milking just yet, but he'll have the way of it soon enough. It's awkward with the one hand, to be sure, but he's..."
I sat down on the log beside her and took hold of her wrist, turning it over.
"Brianna told me," I said. "Did Fergus do this?"
"Oh..." She seemed embarrassed and pulled her wrist away, pressing the forearm against her belly to hide the marks.
"Well, aye, he did."
"Do you want me to speak to Jamie about it?" A rich tide of colour surged into her face and she sat up in alarm.
"Christ, no! That would break Fergus's neck. And it wasn't his fault, really."
"Certainly it was his fault," I said firmly. I had seen all too many beaten women in Boston emergency rooms, all of whom claimed that it wasn't really their husband's or boyfriend's fault. Granted,
The women often did have something to do with it, but still.
But it wasn't, Massali insisted.
The colour had not gone from her face. If anything, it intensified.
He grabbed my arm, but 'twas only because I was trying to brain him with a stick of wood at the time.
She glanced away, blushing fiercely.
Oh!
I rubbed my nose, a little taken aback.
I see.
And why were you trying to do that?
Was he attacking you?
She sighed, shoulders slumping a little.
Oh, no.
Well, it was because Joni spilled the milk, and he shouted at her, and she cried, and... She shrugged a little, looking uncomfortable.
I just had a wee deal sitting on my shoulder, I suppose.
It's not like Fergus to shout at the children, is it?
Oh, no, it's not, she said quickly. He hardly ever...
Well, he didn't have used to, but with so many... Well, I couldn't have blamed him this time. It took him a terrible time to milk the goat, and then to have it all spilt and wasted. I would have shouted too, I expect.
Her eyes were fixed on the ground, avoiding mine, and she was fingering the seam of her shift, running a thumb over and over the stitching.
Small children can certainly be trying, I agreed, with vivid memories of an incident involving a 2-year-old Brianna, a phone call that distracted me, a large bowl of spaghetti with meatballs, and Frank's open briefcase. Frank normally exhibited a saintly degree of patience with Bree, if somewhat less with me. But on that particular occasion, his bellows of outrage had rattled the windows. And now that I recalled the occasion, I actually had thrown a meatball at him in a fury verging on hysteria. So had Bree, though she had done it out of glee rather than vindictiveness. Had I been standing by the stove at the time, it might easily have been the pot I threw.
I rubbed a finger under my nose, not sure whether to regret the memory or to laugh at it. I never did get the stains out of the rug.
It was a shame that I couldn't share the memory with Massali, as she was in ignorance not only of spaghetti and briefcases, but also of Frank. She was still looking down, scuffing at the dead oak leaves with a pointed toe.
"'Twas all my fault, really," she said, and bit her lip.
"'No, it wasn't."
I squeezed her arm in reassurance.
"'Things like that are no one's fault. Accidents happen, people get upset. But it all comes right in the end."
So it did, I thought, though often not in any expected way. She nodded, but the shadow still lay on her face, her lower lip tucked in.
It's only...
she began, then trailed off.
I sat patiently, careful not to push her. She wanted, needed, to talk. And I needed to hear it before deciding what, or if, to tell Jamie. There was something going on between her and Fergus, that was sure.
I was just thinking of it now, whilst I was shoveling. I wouldn't have done it, I don't think. Only it minded me so much. It was only I felt as though it was the same again.
The same as what? I asked, when it became clear that she had trailed off.
I spilt the milk, she said all in a rush, when I was a wean. I was hungry, and I reached to pull the jug, and it spilled.
Oh?
Aye, and he shouted.
Her shoulders hunched a little, as though in memory of a blow.
Who shouted? I dinna ken for sure. It might have been my father, Hugh, but it might have been Simon, Mam's second husband. I dinna really remember, only being so scared that I wet myself, and that made him angrier.
Colour flamed in her face, and her toes curled with shame.
My mother cried, for it was all the food there was, a bit of bread and milk, and now the milk was gone. But he shouted that he couldn't bear the noise, for Joan and I were both howling too. And then he slapped my face, and Mam went for him, bald-headed, and he pushed her so she fell against the hearth and smacked her face on the chimney. I could see the blood running from her nose.
She sniffed and brushed a knuckle under her own nose, blinking, her eyes still fixed on the leaves. She stamped out then, slamming the door, and Joni and I rushed up to Mam, both shrieking our heads off, for we thought she was dead. But she got up onto her hands and knees and told us it was all right. It would be all right. And her swaying to and fro with her cap fallen off and strings of bloody snot dripping from her face onto the floor. I'd forgot that. But when Fergus started shouting at poor wee Joni, 'twas like he was Simon, or maybe Hugh, him, whoever he was. She closed her eyes and heaved a deep sigh, leaning forward so her arms cradled the burden of her pregnancy. I reached out and smoothed the damp strings of hair out of her face, brushing them back from her rounded brow. "You miss your mother, don't you?" I said softly. For the first time I felt some sympathy for her mother, Lyra, as well as for Massali. "Oh, aye," Massali said simply. "Something terrible." She sighed again, closing her eyes as she leaned her cheek against my hand. I drew her head against me, holding her, and stroked her hair in silence. It was late afternoon, and the shadows lay long, cold in the oak wood. The heat had left her now, and she shivered briefly in the cooling air, a stipple of goose flesh coming up on her fine-boned arms. "Here," I said, standing up and swinging the cloak off my shoulders. "Put this on. You don't want to take a chill." "Ah, no, it's all right." She straightened up, shaking back her hair, and wiped her face with the back of a hand. "There's no but a bit more to do here, and then I've got to be going home and making up the supper." "I'll do it," I said firmly, and tucked the cloak around her shoulders. "You rest a bit." The air inside the tiny shed was ripe enough to make one light-headed, all by itself, thick with the fecund musk of sprouting grain and the fine sharp dust of barley hulls. The warmth was welcoming after the chill of the air outside, but within moments my skin was damp beneath dress and shift, and I pulled the gown over my head and hung it on a nail by the door. No matter. She was right. There wasn't much to be done. The work would keep me warm, and then I would walk home with Massali straight away. I would make supper for the family, letting her rest. And while I was about it, I'd perhaps have a word with Fergus and discover more about what was going on. Fergus could have been making the supper, I thought, frowning as I dug into the dim heaps of sticky grain. Not that he would think of such a thing, the little French layabout. Milking the goat was as far as he was likely to go in the direction of women's work. Then I thought of Joan and Félicité, and felt more charitable toward Fergus. Joan was 3, Félicité 1.5, and anyone alone in a house with those two had my complete sympathy, no matter what kind of work they were doing. Joan was outwardly a sweet brown wren of a child, and by herself was even-tempered and biddable. To a point. Félicité was the spitting image of her father, dark, fine-boned, and given to alternate bouts of languishing charm and intemperate passion. Together. Jamie referred to them casually as the Hell Kits, and if they were at home, it was no wonder that Germaine was out wandering in the woods. Nor that Massali found it a relief to be out here by herself doing heavy labour. Heavy was the operative term, I thought, thrusting the shovel in again and heaving. Sprouting grain was damp grain, and each shovelful weighed pounds. The turned grain was patchy, splotched dark with moisture from the underlying layers. The unturned grain was paler in colour, even in the failing light. Only a few mounds of pale grain remained in the far corner. I attacked them with a will, realising as I did so that I was trying very hard not to think of the story Massali had told me. I didn't want to like Lyra, and I didn't. But I didn't want to feel sympathy for her either, and that was proving harder to avoid. It hadn't been an easy life for her, apparently. Well,
Nor had it been for anyone else living in the Highlands then, I thought, grunting as I flung a shovelful of grain to the side. Being a mother was not that easy anywhere, but it seemed she'd made a good job of it. I sneezed from the grain dust, paused to wipe my nose on my sleeve, then went back to shoveling. It wasn't as though she had tried to steal Jamie from me after all, I told myself, striving for compassion and high-minded objectivity. Rather the reverse, in fact. Or at least she might well see it that way. The edge of the shovel gritted hard against the floor as I scraped up the last of the grain. I sent the grain flying to the side, then used the flat of the blade to shove some of the new-turned grain into the empty corner and smooth down the highest hillocks. I knew all the reasons why he said he'd married her, and I believed him. However, the fact remained that the mention of her name conjured up assorted visions, starting with Jamie kissing her ardently in an alcove at Castle Leoch, and ending with him fumbling up her nightgown in the darkness of their marriage bed, hands warm and eager on her thighs. That made me snort like a grampus and feel the blood throb hotly in my temples. Perhaps, I reflected, I was not really a very high-minded sort of person. Occasionally, quite low-minded and grudge-bearing, in fact. This bout of self-criticism was cut short by the sound of voices and movement outside. I stepped to the door of the shed, squinting against the dazzle of the late afternoon sun. I couldn't see their faces, nor even tell for sure how many there might be. Some were on horseback, some on foot, black silhouettes with the sinking sun behind them. I caught a movement in the corner of my eye. Masali was on her feet, backing toward the shed. "Who are you, sirs?" she said, chin high.
"Thirsty travellers, mistress," said one of the black forms, edging his horse ahead of the others. "In search of hospitality."
The words were courteous enough. The voice wasn't. I stepped out of the shed, still gripping the shovel. "Welcome," I said, making no effort to sound welcoming. "Stay where you are, gentlemen. We'll be pleased to bring you a drink. Masali, will you fetch the keg?" There was a small keg of raw whiskey kept nearby for just such occasions. My heartbeat was loud in my ears, and I was clutching the wooden handle of the shovel so tightly that I could feel the grain of the wood. It was more than unusual to see so many strangers in the mountains at one time. Now and then we would see a hunting party of Cherokee, but these men were not Indians.
"No bother, mistress," said another of the men, swinging down off his horse. "I'll help her fetch it. I do think we shall be needing more than one keg, though."
The voice was English and oddly familiar. Not a cultivated accent, but with a careful diction.
"We have only one keg ready," I said, slowly moving sideways and keeping my eyes on the man who had spoken.
He was short and very slender, and moved with a stiff, jerky gait like a marionette. He was moving toward me, so were the others. Masali had reached the woodpile and was fumbling behind the chunks of oak and hickory. I could hear her breath harsh in her throat. The keg was hidden in the woodpile. There was an axe lying next to the wood, too, I knew. "Masali," I said, "stay there. I'll come and help you." An axe was a better weapon than a shovel, but two women against... how many men? 10? 12? More? I blinked, eyes watering against the sun, and saw several more walk out of the wood. I could see these clearly. One grinned at me, and I had to steel myself not to look away. His grin broadened. The short man was coming closer, too. I glanced at him, and a brief itch of recognition tickled me. Who the hell was he? I knew him. I'd seen him before. And yet I hadn't any name to attach to the lantern jaws and narrow brow. He stank of long-dried sweat, dirt ground into the skin, and the tang of dribbled urine. They all did.
and the odour of them floated on the wind, feral as the stink of weasels. He saw me recognise him, thin lips pulled in for a moment, then relaxed.
"Mrs. Fraser," he said,
and the feeling of apprehension deepened sharply as I saw the look in his small, clever eyes. "I think you have the advantage of me, sir," I said, putting as bold a face on it as I might. "Have we met?" He didn't answer that. One side of his mouth turned up a little, but his attention was distracted by the two men who had lunged forward to take the keg as Masali rolled it out of its hiding place. One had already seized the axe I had my eye on and was about to stave in the top of the cask when the thin man shouted at him,
"Leave it!"
The man looked up at him, mouth open in heavy incomprehension.
"I said leave it,"
the thin man snapped, as the other glanced from the cask to the axe and back in confusion.
"We'll take it with us. I'll not have you all befuddled with drink now."
Turning to me as though continuing a conversation, he said,
"Where's the rest of it?"
"That's all there is," Masali said, before I could answer. She was frowning at him, wary of him, but also angry. "Take it, then, and you must." The thin man's attention shifted to her for the first time, but he gave her no more than a casual glance before turning back to me.
"Don't trouble lying to me, Mrs. Fraser. I know well enough there's more, and I'll have it."
"There is not.
Give me that, you great oaf."
Masali snatched the axe neatly from the man holding it and scowled at the thin man. "This is how you repay proper welcome, is it? By thieving? Well, take what you came for and leave, then." I had no choice but to follow her lead, though alarm bells were ringing in my brain every time I looked at the thin little man. "She's right," I said. "See for yourselves." I pointed at the shed, the mash tubs and the pot still that stood nearby, unsealed and patently empty. "We're only beginning the malting. It will be weeks yet before there's a new batch of whisky." Without the slightest change of expression, he took a quick step forward and slapped me hard across the face. The blow wasn't hard enough to knock me down, but it snapped my head back and left my eyes watering. I was more shocked than hurt, though there was a sharp taste of blood in my mouth, and I could already feel my lip beginning to puff. Masali uttered a sharp cry of shock and outrage, and I heard some of the men murmur in interested surprise. They had drawn in, surrounding us. I put the back of my hand to my bleeding mouth, noticing, in a detached sort of way, that it was trembling. My brain, though, had withdrawn to a safe distance, and was making and discarding suppositions so quickly that they fluttered past fast as shuffling cards. Who were these men? How dangerous were they? What were they prepared to do? The sun was setting. How long before Masali or I was missed and someone came looking for us? Would it be Fergus or Jamie? Even Jamie, if he came alone. I had no doubt that these men were the same who had burned Tige O'Brien's house and were likely responsible for the attacks inside the treaty line as well. Vicious, then, but with theft as their major purpose. There was a copper taste in my mouth, the metal tang of blood and fear. No more than a second had passed in these calculations, but as I lowered my hand, I had concluded that it would be best to give them what they wanted and hope that they left with the whiskey at once. I had no chance to say so, though. The thin man seized my wrist and twisted viciously. I felt the bone shift and crack with a tearing pain, and sank to my knees in the leaves, unable to make more than a small, breathless sound. Masali made a louder sound and moved like a striking snake. She swung the axe from the shoulder with all the power of her bulk behind it, and the blade sank deep in the shoulder of the man beside her. She wrenched it free, and blood sprayed warm across my face, pattering like rain upon the leaves. She screamed, high and thin, and the man screamed too. And then the whole clearing was in motion, men surging inward with a roar like collapsing surf. I lunged forward and seized the thin man's knees, butted my head hard upward into his crotch. He made a choking wheeze and fell on top of me, flattening me to the ground.
I squirmed out from under his knotted body, knowing only that I had to get to Marsali, get between her and the men. But they were upon her. A scream cut in half by the sound of fists on flesh, and a dull boom as bodies fell hard against the wall of the malting shed. The clay firepot was in reach. I seized it, heedless of its searing heat, and flung it straight into the group of men. It struck one hard in the back and shattered, hot coals spraying. Men yelled and jumped back, and I saw Marsali slumped against the shed, neck canted over on one shoulder, and her eyes rolled back, white in her head, legs splayed wide, and the shift torn down from her neck, leaving her heavy breasts bare on the bulge of her belly. Then someone struck me on the side of the head, and I flew sideways, skidding through the leaves and ending boneless, flat on the ground, unable to rise or move or think.